This is a UOA on campus production. This podcast was recorded on Kaurna land. We acknowledge the Kaurna people as the original custodians of the land and pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples.
You'll want to make a note.
Should you be taking notes or something?
You got a pencil? Write this down, quick.
Why aren't you taking notes?
Write this down.
Aren't you going to write this down?
Did you need me to take notes?
Please take note.
Hello and welcome to Take Note, the podcast where we give you the best notes on everything you need to know from the day you start uni to the day you graduate. I'm your host and current honours student, Shannon, and today we'll be talking about the big bad wolf of HEX. We'll be chatting with Senior Lecturer in Finance at the Adelaide Business School, George, to learn more about HEX, how much we should be thinking about it, and some tips on how to manage our money. We'll also be giving you the lowdown on how you can get a loan or grant from students care if you're in need of some financial help. Managing money while studying can be a stressful and confusing experience, made even more confusing by the big debt we all have in common, HEX. We thought it was time to look into the belly of the beast and break down what exactly HEX is, how it works, and how stressed we should be about it. Joining me today is Senior Lecturer in Finance at the Adelaide Business School, George, to give us the facts. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've heard all about HEX debt, but could you give us a quick overview of what it actually is?
Absolutely. So the acronym stands for Higher Education Contribution Scheme, and it's actually a part of a bigger program. You'll see it quite often. It says HEX Help. So there's the Higher Education Loan Program. It's kind of the umbrella that HEX sits under. And it's essentially for any students that qualify for a Commonwealth-supported place, predominantly at public Australian universities. So a Commonwealth-supported place essentially means that the government is already paying the universities for part of your education, so there is already a subsidy in place. And then there's a gap between the subsidised amount and the actual cost of your degree. And so the HEX Help program fits in there by allowing students to essentially get a loan for the contribution that they're meant to make to their own education cost if they're unable to pay it up front.
And so most of us have sort of steadily been accumulating this debt over the years, and I guess avoiding looking at the numbers when we do our tax returns. But how does it actually work? When can we expect that number to start to come down?
So that's an excellent question. It's a little bit nuanced. There's a little bit of detail that goes into it. The way that it works is it accrues as you progress through your degree program. So at each census date, each year, the debt accumulates depending on the courses that you're enrolled in and how much they cost. That debt is transferred to the tax office, at which point you become liable for it officially, I suppose. So, you know, if you unenroll prior to the census date, you actually don't get a HEX liability. And the way that the tax office then handles it is based on your taxable income. So there are thresholds and there's a schedule published online that details how the tax office expects you to repay the debt. I think roughly it's something like you're meant to make a 1% contribution from your annual taxable income if you earn somewhere between like roughly $50,000 or $60,000 a year. And that goes all the way up to 10% of your taxable income if you're earning in excess of $150,000 a year. Which of course also means that for those in the audience that are listening that have a part-time job while they're studying, if your part-time job means that you're earning less than that minimum threshold, then you won't be expected to make any repayment while that goes on.
Good to know, I think. And are there any limits to how much you can borrow or for how long you can sort of, I guess, be pulling on the HEX
system.
Yeah, absolutely. There are now, yes, they weren't always in place. So, you know, kind of showing my age here a little bit. When I studied back in the mid to late 2000s, I don't know of a limit on the amount of time that you could be eligible for HECS. But there is now, I'm going to butcher the acronym, I think it's like a student entitlement, student learning entitlement, something like that. So that is a limit imposed by the government a couple of years ago, whereby students are only eligible for HECS up to 7 years equivalent full-time studying. And in terms of financially, the general limit, I think, is somewhere around $120,000 worth of debt is where it maxes out. And that ceiling is higher if you're in a more expensive program. So if you're medicine or,
dental, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Veterinary sciences, I think, are included. Also some aviation courses, I think, are part of it as well. That limit goes up to like $175,000 or thereabouts in total debt that you're allowed to accumulate
under the program. And I think a question a lot of us have is sort of, what if we move overseas? I think a lot of people think about the job market overseas. So
absolutely.
Yeah. What would be the result, I guess, for our debt if we do make that move?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've heard of the strategies to avoid having to pay it back. Absolutely. You remain liable for it at all times, no matter where you go, even internationally. And if you earn a foreign income, then that gets considered as part of the way that the tax office will then base the ratio which you're meant to repay the HECS loan back at. So you're not exempt from it if you move overseas. If you move overseas and never return to Australia, I don't know what sort of enforcement capacity the tax office has, but look, I would advise against trying to dodge the debt. It is a debt that others haven't had to pay, but it's only a portion of the actual total cost.
Some people have, I guess, thrown around the terms maybe like good or bad debt, but where does HECS sit within that?
Yeah, so I don't know that you, this is a really outstanding question. I don't know if you actually understand how outstanding it is. Typically, the way that we would characterize good versus bad debt revolves around whether it's for consumption or for investment. And if we look at HECS closely, it's an investment, it's a debt that you accrue in order to gain an education, which is a direct investment into your personal development and your human capital. So it's absolutely a good debt, because at least in theory, there are no limits on the returns that you might be able to achieve with your talent and work ethic and knowledge and skills. So from that perspective, it's very much a good debt. It's far better than buying a TV, which just depreciates to zero, no matter what you do with it.
I guess a car loan is probably something similar too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, debt is good if it leads to you buying assets, and assets are distinguished from consumables precisely in that typically their value rises over time, or they're able to generate some sort of return. And it doesn't necessarily have to be financial. If we look at it from a social perspective, as the social lens, there are a lot of non-financial benefits to having an informed populace, an educated populace. It strengthens society. It strengthens democracy. There are a lot of side effects that are beneficial. I don't want to sound like I'm shilling for the government, but yes, I think HECS debts are a good debt. And it's just about, managing them responsibly, paying them back at a certain rate, like any other sort of consumer credit.
So I guess it's something we probably shouldn't be too scared of accruing.
No, I certainly wouldn't say scared. I mean, I know these, you know, you come out, you're a fresh grad, you've got your first job, and you look at this balance and it's like a six-figure number, you know, in many cases. Most HECS debts, I imagine, would be five digits. It can be a little bit intimidating, but I the way that it embeds with the rest of the tax system, it's essentially works like any other levy, right? Mm-hmm. The way that you repay it. The levy, the Medicare levy, for example, that gets indexed over time and it rises, right? Depending on the cost of healthcare. Your HECS debt also gets indexed over time. So that can be a little bit disheartening. And the size of the balance, even without any indexation, is obviously very large. But it does progressively go down over time for most people. And it's not something that I would fear.
Yeah. And I guess there's always the option to pay back part of your HECS on your own accord that isn't actually part of your HECS repayments system. So what are the benefits, I guess, of trying to pay back that HECS early, or are there actually any benefits?
That's an excellent question. It absolutely depends on your individual circumstances. And I don't want to sound like I'm dodging the question, but it's just the truth of the matter is it's conditional on what else you could do with the money that you're spending to repay the debt. So if you have nothing better to do with it, if the interest rate environment is very low, for example, if you can't get a decent term deposit, if the money is just sitting around in your bank account, absolutely, it makes great sense to repay your HECS debt and to reduce the amount of indexation that it's going to get. But on the other hand, if you're able to do something more productive with the money, let's say, I know the numbers changed quite dramatically during the, but just on the back end of the pandemic, because there's a lot of inflation in the system generally. But if, you know, historically, the indexation rate on HECS has been in line with the CPI, Consumer Price Index. It's about 2%. It's a little, some years a bit higher, some years a bit lower, but generally speaking, it's around 2%. So if you have, let's say you've saved $1,000, if you're able to invest it, let's say you put it in a bank in a term deposit that pays you 4%, and you know that we're in a stable inflationary environment and your HECS debt is going to get indexed at 2%, well, you're much better off leaving that money in the term deposit rather than paying off the HECS debt. And of course, there are other places where you can seek much larger returns, right? You can start looking at equities, right? So stocks, buying shares on the Australian Stock Exchange, or internationally, if you're feeling that brave and that inclined, you understand foreign exchange rates and all the rest of it. But of course, you know, that all sounds very risky. So if you're not sure how to do any of that or what to do in that space, then there's help, there's financial advice, there are index funds. So there's lots of options, that can generate you a higher return than the rate at which your HECS debt gets indexed. Last year's was very high, right? The indexation was like something like 7%.
Yeah.
So, that's pretty frightening, right? You have a $50,000 debt and you see it jump by $3,500. That's quite a lot. But of course, you're probably still able to find lots of places where you can invest your money and earn a return greater than 7%. Just the whole example with term deposits and bank accounts, that one is off the table, right? Because you're not going to get that sort of return on a term deposit right now. But, you know, equity markets have rebounded fairly strongly, and so the returns there have been pretty remarkable. If you're fortunate enough to be in a position to invest in property, the property market is also...
Yeah.
And I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand, right? The reason your HECS debt was indexed at 7% is kind of the same reason why property prices have skyrocketed and the equity markets have rebounded. There's just a lot of excess cash in the system, and it's driving inflation everywhere. It's driving it in the grocery store, in asset prices, everywhere. So the real hope there is the main mitigating factor actually is not just the interest rates increasing and them reducing inflation, but also you hope that some of that inflation makes it into wages.
Yeah.
Because if the wage increases at the same rate as the costs increase, the average wage, then you're probably okay. It's when those two things are out of step that you kind of end up in trouble.
Yeah, and a lot of savings accounts have, you know, you can set them up to have quite a big interest. When the interest rates are high, you can get quite a lot back if you've got a decent amount in that savings account too.
Absolutely.
And a lot of students work pretty hard while they're studying to try and earn and save enough money to actually do begin paying back that HEC debt as soon as they can. Mm-hmm. Do you have any financial tips for students looking to manage their money better and build up that savings account?
I do. I don't know how popular this will be. So I'm not sure if you're aware. I can't remember what it's called. It's very old. It's from like the 1970s originally. And I know it's been criticized since then for various reasons. But the original work is from Stanford in the 1970s. Something called the marshmallow test. Mm-hmm. You ever heard of this? The marshmallow experiment?
Is this the one where they sort of give kids marshmallows and say, if you wait 10 minutes, then we'll give you more marshmallows, and the ones that show they could wait had better, I guess, life outcomes?
Correct. Absolutely. That's precisely what I'm talking about. And so that whole, it's a psychological study, but it's essentially, it's examining what we call delayed gratification. Now, I know that it's being criticized because originally that the authors kind of overreached a little bit, and they try to say, you know, you're going to have better life outcomes in multiple areas, including, you know, your body mass index and your health and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's old research, and so there's lots of reasons to criticize it. But the essential idea of it, I think, still holds true. Especially in an economic setting.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, you know, if you ask me what's the best thing that students can do in terms of improving their financial situation, first of all, the fact that they are students is already a massive step forward because it shows that they are willing to sacrifice the potential salary, or at least part of it, that they are currently able to get in the marketplace in order to invest in their human capital. So that's one way of looking at delayed gratification.
Love that perspective.
Absolutely. But that's not the only thing, because look, everyone can stand to benefit from delayed gratification, not just students, right? Mm-hmm. You could be an apprentice, right? Or you could be just working straight out of high school. If you sacrifice your current desires and interests, and that allows you to save money at the moment, the returns on that compound over time. The more you sacrifice now, the better off you will be eventually. Now, of course, there's a tipping point at some point, right? I don't want people hoarding money until they're pensioners, and you know now everyone's a millionaire, but no one has the health to go and travel.
Totally.
Okay, so it depends on your personal circumstances. It depends on what your personal objectives are, what you're interested in. But what I would recommend is that if you're able to exercise a little bit of self-discipline. I'll give you an example, right? This is a popular student example. I remember being, you know, 16, 18, 20. Wasn't always ideal living at home.
Yeah.
I know it's not an option for everyone, of course. I'm not oblivious to that fact. But if living at home is an option for you, of course it's less than ideal.
Mm.
Parents' rules, the chores they make you do, the limitations on your social life, etc. But if you're able to stomach that for a few years, stay home, either rent-free or pay some sort of token rent to your parents, that's far better than going out and that money leaving your family. That's far better in terms of cost sharing on utilities and groceries and all the rest of it that goes into cost of living. And so if you can make that sacrifice, especially if you're working, setting money aside, but even if you're not, avoiding having to pay commercial rents and commercial utilities and the rest of it.
And there's rising costs too.
Absolutely. You're far better off. And that, I mean, I understand that's not applicable to everyone. There's some situations where it's just not available to you. I'm very sensitive to that. But then I would say delayed gratification could be don't get the new iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Don't buy that TV.
Mm-hmm. The non-essentials.
Yeah, exactly. Anything that can wait, leave it for later. You know, if you like a nice new car, you know, don't get a car loan for $20,000. Instead, go to the second-hand car market and see if you can get something for $10,000. Of course, you're going to get an inferior product. I absolutely understand that. But that's the whole point because, you know, if you do that now, later on, you might be able to get that luxury sedan where you actually pay it off comfortably and you're not, you know, buried under a car loan as well as your HEX debt, as well as a mortgage and the rest of it.
Hi there, University of Adelaide students. My name is Chelsea, and welcome to Mindful Moment, brought to you by the Student Health and Wellbeing Team. When feeling overwhelmed by debt, take a moment to reflect on your financial journey. Look back at the progress you've made, no matter how small, and remind yourself that each step forward is an achievement. Use this time to reassess your budget, set realistic goals, and explore new strategies for managing debt. It's a moment of mindfulness that helps you stay focused and positive on your path towards financial health. Thank you for taking this moment with me. Your well-being is important. And until next time, take care and be kind to yourself. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at U of A Student Wellbeing.
And I guess playing into that instant or delayed gratification thing, we've got things like buy now, pay later companies, which do sort of allow you to pay things over a few installments so you can get the thing right now.
Yep.
Are they something that we should be wary of, I guess, as students?
It's like reverse lay-by, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I remember as a child, you know, my mum would take me to Kmart, Target, whatever. She'd find something that she wants for the house and she'd put it on lay-by, quotation marks. Which is very interesting, right? Because you on lay-by, you don't get the product
exactly
up front. You get it once you make all your payments. Buy now, pay later basically reverses that. And that it's anti-delayed gratification,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
You see this in a lot of places in society, right? I mean, I remember as a child going to Blockbuster. And, you know, we have to get in the car, we have to go to the store, sit there, pick, you know, physically walk around, flick through the DVDs or back, even before that, the VHS tapes, and then take it home. It was like you plan, it's an event, right?
Yes.
At the end of it, you have to rewind the tape back, you have to make sure you return the DVD. Now it's just scroll and click on Netflix, right? So society is absolutely moving in this convenience direction.
Mm.
It's not immediately apparent if the convenience of things like Afterpay, Zip, right, the buy now, pay later providers, it's not immediately clear that they are either a good thing or a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of agnostic. It depends on your personal situation and it also depends on the level of discipline that you approach them with, right? If you've carefully planned out your usage, and you know you'll be able to make the repayments as scheduled and you won't be subject to some of the fees and interest rate charges that start to accrue and that's where, you know, the costs kind of get out of hand, then absolutely you can use them. They're like any other credit product, right? On the other hand, if you know that you're going to struggle with the discipline or if you're unsure about how you're going to make those repayments, then yeah, absolutely, it's probably something you should be wary of.
Mm, I guess like you mentioned, it is a credit product. So does the use of those companies or services have an impact on, say, things like your credit score later down the track if you are trying to get loans on other things, such as a mortgage?
Yeah, so I don't know for certain. I'd imagine it would. You know, credit scores they're a complex beast. A lot of data inputs get fed into a credit score. I don't see, I mean, of course, if that data is available to the banks and to the credit scoring agencies, I don't see why they wouldn't use it. I mean, they use all sorts of demographics and all sorts of repayment histories and how you've handled previous debts and credit cards and what you have outstanding and all that sort of stuff, along with demographics like, you know, your age and lots of different things. So in principle, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't if they can get their hands on it. And I'd imagine they'd be able to get their hands on it because they could just approach the companies like Afterpay and Zip. I just don't know for a fact that they are doing that right now. But yeah. My assumption would be, yes, absolutely they are.
Something to keep in mind, I guess. And I guess finally, you know, there's sort of this big question when it comes to Hex about, does it actually carry with me when I die? Is it something I'm going to be carrying into the afterlife?
Well, now we're getting a little bit not just philosophical, but maybe even theological. I know what the stance is of the tax office. I don't know that you would be very worried about debts in the afterlife. But so the way the repayments on your Hex debt are calculated by the tax office, and what that's based on, is your taxable income. So up to the point that you are still with us, and I hope that that's for many long years for everyone listening and for ourselves included, then your estate becomes liable to make that Hex repayment on your behalf after you pass away. But if you have an outstanding debt which had not yet accrued payable based on the income that you had received while you were alive, then all of that is forgiven. So if you have a $100,000 debt and you've earned $50,000 this year, you're liable to pay 1% of your taxable income towards your Hex debt. That's about $500. If you've worked for half the year, that $500 is about $250 in the first 6 months of the year. If you, under unfortunate circumstances, pass away at that stage, the tax office can claim that $250 from your estate. But the rest of the $100,000 that you owe that had not yet come payable, that is forgiven by the government.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, George.
It's been a pleasure, absolutely. It's a very interesting topic. I know it's very front of mind. It's very relevant for a lot of folks. But I want to. I don't want to leave everyone on a grim note about passing away. I will say this: Hex debts can seem intimidating. And they are obviously very large. Anyone who is looking at benchmarking what Australia's system is like versus what happens in, say, for example, the US, there's a lot of reason to be positive about our system and to be, I don't want to say upbeat, but just
optimistic.
Just to be okay with the debt. Like it's just an extra tax that you pay later on once you start working, and you will be fine because your education hopefully predisposes you to getting a great job and out earning your Hex debt many, many times over, which I think is the main thing, right? You're here to study and improve yourself, to invest in your human capital, and to strengthen your earning potential, your lifetime earning potential in the long run.
Thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Hi everyone, just a quick warning that the audio in this next section is a little patchy, but we thought what our next guest had to share was so good, we knew you'd want to hear what she had to say.
It's common knowledge that as students, we often struggle with money, with our studies getting in the way of us working and earning. However, if you are in need of some financial help, Student Care might be able to help you out with a student loan, a grant, or even a scholarship. We're joined today by Anne from Student Care to tell us more about how you might be able to access that financial help. So thank you so much, Anne, for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Shannon. It's nice to be invited to speak with you.
Could you give us a bit of a rundown on what financial assistance Student Care can actually offer students?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So Student Care, and many students will know this, is a welfare and advocacy support service, which comes under the umbrella of UX, and we provide support and advocacy to students who are enrolled at the University of Adelaide. A number of things that we do is provide support with financial assistance in the form of grants, and there's seven different grants that Student Care actually either interviews, assesses and makes recommendations for, and some of them we also administer. Many of those are in conjunction with the university, and the funds and grants that I'm thinking of are the Student Emergency Fund, the Walter Dorothy Duncan Trust, which was a bequest to the university many years ago, AR Riddles Scholarship, and a number of others. What is common in all of the grants that we offer is that there's a criteria around financial hardship. So students do need to demonstrate that they are experiencing financial hardship, and that can often be through, you know, loss of employment or inability to source employment, or perhaps a family or a social circumstances happen which is impacting on their cost of living. Very common for most students who are enrolled at the university.
Yeah, totally. And what is the difference between, say, a loan or maybe a grant?
Yeah, it's a good question. If you're successful with a grant, there is no expectation that you will repay that money. It's a grant provided to you to assist you with whatever the costs are that you are requiring assistance with. A student loan, on the other hand, which is administered by the university and funds made available through the university, but the education and welfare officers at Student Care will do the assessment for domestic students. Student advisors with international student support will do the assessment and recommendations for students, international students. There is an expectation if you take out a student loan that you will repay that loan. It is interest-free, and a loan will never exceed $2,000. For students who are commencing in their first study period, the maximum is $750 that a student can loan. To be recommended and be approved for a student loan, you do need to demonstrate that you have the capacity to repay that loan. So it could be as little as $10 a week that you are repaying. The loan has to be paid in the life of your program of study, and very often it's preferred that it be paid within the 12-month period of when you take out the loan.
Okie dokie. So, yeah, if you're sort of setting up that framework to pay it back, what might that look like?
Just to clarify, if you're repaying a loan, you at the time that you have the interview for the loan, you will speak with, be it an education and welfare officer or an international student support officer, and you'll talk about, this is my budget, this is what my income is, this is what my expenditure is. At minimum, a student is required to make a repayment each month. If a student chooses to pay on a weekly basis, terrific, or a fortnightly basis, what the requirement is that you pay an agreed amount at minimum each month over the life of your loan. And as I mentioned before, typically that would be within a 12-month period. For some students who may be early in their undergraduate degree, or they may be a postgraduate student where they know they're going to be studying for well over a 12-month period, there is the opportunity to negotiate a longer period of time. But it's preferable if your budget will support the repayment of the loan within the 12-month period, that's what we'd encourage.
Yeah, that's good. So students will have basically people help them work out what is feasible for them, because I'm sure budgeting isn't sort of, I guess, on the brain of every first-year student in particular.
Yeah, and we would never, ever recommend or approve a loan if we felt that it was going to compromise a student or put them in debt that they didn't have the capacity to repay. The idea is that the student loan is helpful, not actually a burden.
Yeah, absolutely. And how should someone go about finding out a bit more information about maybe their eligibility for some of these loans or grants?
Yeah, so probably the easiest thing is to contact Student Care, and you can contact us at our email, which is studentcare@adelaide.edu.au, or contact us directly by phone. Our offices are also in Level 8 of the Hughes Building, so that is accessible through the ground floor of the hub.
Yeah, if someone listening wants maybe just a bit more information about each of those individual things that are available, where might they be able to go?
Oh, absolutely. Look on our website, the Student Care website, which is also can be found on the UX web pages. The other thing is student loan. You can just type into the search engine at the university, student loan or student care grants. The university has obviously the coursework scholarships office, and there is a whole list of scholarships and grants that are available that go beyond what is within our remit even.
Yeah. And is there anything else you'd like students to know about that service?
I guess what I would say in terms of student care, we also, if students are finding it really difficult around food support, I just want to give a plug for Breakfast Club that we run Tuesday to Friday between 8:30 and 10:30. We're in a new location in 2024 on the ground floor of Hartley Building. We also, if students are struggling in terms of finding or being able to make ends meet in terms of food support, absolutely worth contacting student care in terms of potential options that might be available through food bank and other sources.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Anne.
That's my pleasure.
If you are looking for more ways that you can save money as a student, keep an eye out for student discount services like Uni Days or Student Beans, as well as on any of the websites or cafes that you regularly visit. You'd be surprised by how many places you can actually get a discount. We'll have links to these things and anything else we've mentioned today in our show notes for you to take a look at. And that's all we have time for. So thank you so much for listening in to today's episode of Take Note. If you enjoyed the show, then please follow us on Spotify and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts so that other students can find us too. You can also head over to Instagram where you can follow us at uoa.oncampus and feel free to DM us there with any thoughts you might have on the show. We would really love to hear what you think. This episode was produced by myself and I will see you next fortnight for another episode of Take Note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.